Hello and welcome to a new episode of Blocktails Unchained Story. My name is Sarah and I'm the Managing Director of Blockchain Founders Group. And today I have Roy Bernheim with me. Super happy to have you here. And yeah, please make a quick introduction.
Hey, Sarah. Super nice to be here. Thank you. So I'm Roy Bernheim and I'm one of the co-founders of Becommerce and Sativo.
Super, thank you. We will definitely talk about that later. So maybe let's start with our quick question. How would you explain your Web3 everyday life to your grandma?
So my Web3 everyday life. Okay, so my grandma has Facebook. She has a Facebook account.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So what I would say is, so imagine your Facebook account was your bank account. And so you store your money in your bank. And then if you wanted to change from one bank to another bank, they would let you go, but they would keep your money.
Oh, wow. That's really, really bad. But this explanation is super nice. Wow, this is really cool. I like that.
And this is what happens with your data.
Wow, I really like that. And I think your grandma would agree that something needs to be changed on that side, because I think nobody will leave the money somewhere behind only because of changing the bank account. Cool, nice, thank you.
Yes, you get very worried, I think, for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's true. So maybe let's start with how did you get into blockchain? So where did your journey start? When was it? And what happened?
So my blockchain journey started in 2016 in Burma or Myanmar. When I was still based in Asia, a friend of mine told me about this project he had found in Burma. And it's a climate project that you could buy some sort of token online for a dollar. And for each of those tokens, they would then plant a mangrove tree on the Burmese coast. And not only that, but they also registered with carbon credits. So then if you hold those tokens on some kind of app, they would pay you out money for holding that. And
wow, sounds difficult, to be honest, in the first moment.
Sounds difficult. And also, so my mind started spinning. It was like, well, what is it now? Is it just a token or is it worth something? And then he was like, yeah, you can also resell it. At some point, the price will get float. So that you might even have some kind of a stock market for it. And yeah, of course, the question started triggering in my mind.
Okay, so, and after you've heard about the project, what did you decide to do? And I mean, what has happened to the project now? Because like carbon credits got huge like 1 year ago, as far as I remember. So maybe maybe 8 months ago, it started that many people started talking about carbon credits. But you said you already heard about that back in 2016. So what did you decide to do and what happened to the project?
So we started. So this was my friend Tom and I. What we did, we got back to the project with a list of about, I think it was something 5 to 10 questions to find out a bit more what it is and how it worked. And when we got the answers, we got back to them with about 50 questions because we just wanted to really understand. I mean, there was no proper, let's say, regulatory framework around this. There was no classification of a token, all those things that by now have a name and some kind of direction in most countries, at least. So I started to really just learn more about it. And this was next to my full-time job that I had. That was also why I was based in Asia. I worked for a 35,000 people consumer goods company down there. So we just started spending our evenings finding out more about that project. And then when I left the company about 9-12 months later, I decided to take 4 months to find out more about two topics in particular. One of those was then blockchain. So I started attending quite a few events. That was early 17, mid 17, and started also working on some projects back then on a voluntary basis just to learn more. Yeah, so I started to really get engaged and find out more, not only on the climate side, but then also some, I mean, Yeah, back then it wasn't really called DeFi, but what would now classify as DeFi.
Okay, but did you decide to invest in the project, or did you first do some more research and trying to understand the whole everything around blockchain?
I did invest something. I mean, it was, you could start with $1, so I started to play around with it, and of course, I then also bought tokens. They were called free tokens. Also started getting more involved in a solar project that had the promise to pay out people that plugged into the grid their solar panels back then. So yeah, I started to say invest, play around, and learn more about
Trying by doing, or learning by doing.
it. Exactly.
So, what was the point where you really started to believe in blockchain and the technology? What was the reason where you thought, okay, this might be really interesting and that might change a lot?
So for me, it was really then when I saw that application the first time with how they were raising funds effectively from people worldwide. I mean, they raised, I think by the end it was over 500,000. So they planted more than 500,000 trees through this, which was enabled by this technology in a project in a very remote area that is not that even. It only opened to telcos in 2012, I believe. So that was for
Wow.
me mind-blowing how quickly the adoption and the impact, the real-life impact, could be of such a technology. Of course, I had heard about Bitcoin, this one before as well, but when I saw what the impact really was, I was completely taken in.
Wow, that's really I also like the all those cases about now it's called the refi space. Again, we have a real we have a name for it and we have a classification, and I think refi is one of the most important topics coming up within the next years, because it's I think everybody knows that we need to do something positive for the planet, and refi can really help with that. So, but before you founded your own Web3 or blockchain startup, you decided to do something else, which was not really blockchain related. So, why did you do something else before, and how did you, find your way back to, or really founding a Web3 startup?
Yeah. So during that phase in 2017, when I was learning more about blockchain and got really engaged in working on projects, I then found out, especially back then, it was, as I think now everybody knows, in the second half of 2017 in particular, a lot of projects and a lot of people got drawn to just the price increases, and all of a sudden everything seemed possible and everybody was the next so and so. And because I was generally very excited about what would be able to be built, I then a lot of times realized that not much was being built, when I really started being deeper and wanting to contribute to build, at that time. So that's why I then decided to go more into the e-commerce route, which was the second area that I was really interested in and which was also a background that I had. And that's why I then, well, got introduced through my oldest best friend to my co-founder now, Alan,
Nice.
where we started our direct-to-consumer menswear brand.
So you just said in 2000, back in 2017, you had like some negative experiences, or you were a little disappointed because like it was only more or less a hype, but not so many people were really focusing on building. And this was for you the main reason to decide first to go to another area or to another business, and not to already start building in the Web3 or in the blockchain space. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think you could summarize it like that, or I didn't get to those projects, let's put it that way. Yes.
Okay, understand. Yeah, so you started with Tibo, I guess.
Yes.
And yeah, maybe you want to tell us a little about what you did there, and what you're selling and what you're producing. And as far as I know, approximately 1 year ago, you started with the company called Decommerce. And maybe you can also let us know how you bridged from Tibo to D-commerce. And yeah, tell us a little about what happened and your way.
Absolutely. So then at the end of 17, Alan and I, we founded Tibo, which is we started with men's boxer shorts. And the reason for that was because from one side, we did the analytical approach to find out in terms of market sizing and also in terms of unit economics, so repeat purchase rates, et cetera, et cetera. And I think secondly, and the bigger part, and I think the more interesting part as well, is that we started to actually ask a lot of questions in forums and in social media groups about how guys felt about products generally. So it wasn't really focused even on clothing. It could have been any other product. And the more we started asking questions and more feedback we got, we really realized that guys were super unhappy with their boxer shorts back
Really,
then.
this is so funny because,
And
sorry to interrupt, but like women normally go for shopping and talk so much about clothes and they take care about everything and the brand and like everything is so important. But now you said like for guys, nobody really to care about what they, yeah, their opinion basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really from there we realized that it kind of opened a fuse. It almost felt like they weren't being listened to. So it was like when somebody asked questions, they felt like, oh, finally we can, fix some things that were just not addressed. And because neither Alan nor I have a fashion background or a designer background, we started doing this a bit more in a structured way. So I remember we had our first 5,000 email subscribers quite early on, and we sent out this super long survey. It was over 20 questions, open-ended questions, and we got a reply rate of over 40%.
Wow, this
And
is super high. Crazy.
that's what we thought. So that's why we then made really this feedback loop, which we later found out has a name. It's called co-creation. We made this the centerpiece of what TiVo stands for and what we really focus on and differentiate ourselves with. So we built a community around that. We called it we're the community-led brand, and we then later also then realized that it has other benefits. Like for example, people are much more likely to come back, 3 times more likely to come back to your web shop when they're engaged in that way and really part of shaping what they wear in our case.
So the community can still vote or participate in how you're building the product.
Yeah, exactly. So then the process, right? So we first started off asking questions on social media and then sometimes in an email and then just at an event maybe. So it was data points coming in from different sides. And it was at that point a bit tough to then really have it in one place and really
Can
use that
imagine.
power of the data that people were willing and wanting to actually share with us because we would then bring better products to them. And that's why we then decided to develop our own software, which would allow community members to hang out and then also share ideas and even also lifestyle topics in our own brand space. So directly on our website and not being dependent on third-party social media platforms.
But at that point of time, was still a pure Web 2 company, right? Because like you're talking about communities, and communities is something very well known from the Web 3, 3 space. But in your case, we are still on the Web 2 world, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Alan and I, we both always had this on, let's say, on the private side, so not TiVo side. We're always very engaged with Web3, and we were always, from a mindset point of view, we always knew that TiVo really is based on the similar mindset and this culture of putting the community first. But somehow on the technology side, it wasn't there yet. So yes, so that was still Web2. Up until mid of 2021.
And yeah, what happened afterwards? Because yes, I already said it, you founded Decommerce in January 2022, And so I think Tebow still exists, so people can still buy your products. But there must be, yeah, anything must have happened that you decided to found another company. I mean, I think it wasn't because you had been bored, but there had been many other reasons, I guess.
Yeah, so we built the software that I mentioned earlier. Well, back then it was the community space, we call it our community software. And we started seeing huge positive effects on our unit economics. So I mentioned earlier, one was, for example, that people that were part of this community on our web shop, that we could also communicate directly. So we were not dependent on the algorithm of some platform. And I think they are still emotionally much more vested, because they can shape the future of the brand. We started seeing those big effects and started talking about it, of course, as well. We were at a couple of conferences and we got interest from other brands.
So, quick question in between. Why is only why I think I know that some brands are doing something similar, but not a lot. So, do you know why? Because it seems to be very obvious that it helps to engage customers if you do something like co-creation. Why do only some brands do it?
That's we had the same question, really. It seemed to us so natural to do, and we found out that there were a couple of reasons. One of them is, for example, the just purely how the companies are set up. So if you really fully want to embrace and authentically want to embrace this community-led approach, you need to change your structure from how you've been doing things.
Understand. Okay.
Because all of a sudden, it's not just top down, this is what I want. Maybe you have an in-house designer, maybe you have a whole team, and pushing it down and telling the factories how to produce it and then pushing it out to the market. And then the marketing team starts kicking in. But you actually pull in your marketing or your communication team right at the start.
Understand.
And you have to bring that into your supply chain as well if you really want to be serious about it. So I think that's one part where some might be a bit maybe hesitant at the beginning to really fully do that. And I think the second one is I think same thing with e-commerce. I think everybody knew that it's going to come back 10, 15 years ago. But how to do it. So the know-how, the knowledge of how to really do that, I think wasn't there, especially at the time.
Yeah, I understand. I think if a company is kind of up and running, it's super hard to change processes, especially if it's not only like 10 people or something like that, but if it's like a huge company with some hundred of employees, it might be super hard to change it. Wow. Okay, interesting. Got that.
Back then and now, what we see, so we have one very big example, Nike, for example, which is really spearheading and put out that big commitment to do this. And we're now seeing that other brands are now looking at options of how they could enable to truly onboard their community. So I think those kind of spearhead or lighthouse projects are happening now. But I think back then when we started Tebow, it was not there yet.
Interesting. So you already had your community in the Web 2 space, and then you decided to found d-commerce. So why?
So the reason was really the feedback from the market. So we had our community, we have a community of about 400,000 members with Tebow. And then we started, as we were invited at some conferences, to talk about the effects that the software had. We also did a project with ETH Zurich, the technical university in Zurich, with data scientists, a third-party study that basically gave us back the data that confirmed that the positive impacts are really there. And based on the feedback from those other brands that were really interested whether they could not also maybe use this software, if that was possible in some way, where we then took the decision on the board that it makes sense to white label the solution to, you know, continue keep TiVo, of course, but then also spin out and white label the solution to onboard and accelerate with as a software product for other brands.
Understand. So, what's your mission, or do you have something like a mission? What comes into your mind? What do you want to change, or how do you want to influence the Web3 space with what you're doing?
Absolutely. So for me, the inspiration really came from this very first project that I talked about in Myanmar in terms of the mission. And what it showed me back then is that what we want to bring into the commerce world. So what our mission is to make commerce equitable. What we mean by that is that the different ecosystem participants, so that could be brands, it could be influencers, creators, photographers, designers, shoppers, that each of them bring a certain value to the table. And we want to help and enable that all of those ecosystem participants get remunerated and participate in an equitable way in the value that they bring.
Okay, understand. So, how are you doing that? So, what is your can you describe it a little more for our audience to understand it a little better, how your product works, and what are your why should I use it? Or as a company, why should I call you and ask for your product?
So maybe what it is very briefly, and then I can explain why to use it. So what it is, you can think of it, what it looks like, it's a plugin to your website. It could be a web shop, but it doesn't have to be. It could also be a landing page or any website where in your own look and feel, so your own branding, you can offer a social space. So it's something like between a Facebook meets Reddit, where people can create rooms, they can share posts, they can like, they can download, upvote, also comment, the usual characteristics. But the big difference is that it can either sit really directly in your web shop on your site, so not somewhere completely away, or in your app, or on a microsite, for example. If you want to host a campaign for a specific time period, then this can be on a separate landing page as well. And that's the front end of it. That there's of course a whole back end where you can see all the insights of what's happening in your community space. You can also manage that. There is some moderation. We have also built in some AI moderation to help you to maintain that. But then why to use it? I think that's super important. And the big reason why brands use it is because they've realized that this promise of direct to consumer that I think was so big over the past 10, 15 years is true for selling. So you can sell directly through your website. But a lot of brands have made themselves completely reliant on the communication channel through social media platforms. And what we do is that we don't own the data that happens in the community space. So if you were to host, you know, Sarah's community space, we are the software and infrastructure that enables everything to happen there. But the data is actually between you and your community members. And that's a huge part. What that also means, of course, then for then more on the business side, you can then highly segment because you can find out what do people talk about, what is relevant, what isn't. We connect with all sorts of existing platforms like Shopify, Klaviyo as an email marketing tool, Yotpo, loyalty, etc. And the important part here is the remuneration bit. So that's where it becomes this equitable part, is that the brand can actually set up bounties for the community members, which is then rewarded and remunerated through Web3 and blockchain technology.
Nice, I like that. So you said like the e-commerce promise from back then, several years, is only true partly because at the moment, people can sell directly, but the community is hosted, let's put it that way, on other platforms, for example, LinkedIn or Facebook. So what do you know about those platforms and why is it a problem? Because my experience is it's always negative if you depend on somebody else, especially if it's like huge companies. And I mean, this is one of the important thoughts from Web3. So you have a have an high independent on other companies, and sometimes they just change things and you don't know what has happened. But you maybe it's hard to access your followers and your customers. So what do you know about this and what's going on in that space at the moment?
Yeah, so I think those platforms are extremely relevant and important now for certain things. However, I think one number that is very shocking and that very few people know is that the organic reach number. So organic reach is defined in the social space as the amount of followers or the percentage of followers that you can reach that already follow you with posting something without paying for it. So let's say you have 100 followers, you make a post. How many people from your 100 followers see that in their feed?
No idea.
So, yeah, so that number, I don't know it for all the different platforms. I happen to know it for Facebook. It went from about 20% organic reach to under 2%.
Wow, this is really bad. I mean, if I have 100 followers, it means that one or two people only see what I post.
Yes,
Wow, this is
exactly.
like really bad. Okay.
So if as a brand or an influencer, you've built your followership over all those years and you might have spent a lot of money even building your followership, definitely a lot of time. Now, 98 of those followers don't even see your post unless you promote the post.
Do you know why?
I think there are two topics that influence that. For one is that the adoption rates of the users, so new user generated on those quite mature social media platforms has it increased or but with less growth rates or stagnated or sometimes decreased. And at the same time, you have more supply of posts. So on one side, you have your screens or your users, which is a real estate that people can display what they want to show. The supply side has been flat, and the demand for those screens has gone up. So in essence, you have a bigger battle for those screens. That's
I
one
understand.
big
Okay.
impact. And the second one is, of course, pressure to monetize the users more as well.
So companies rely on the platforms and they especially kind of getting forced to pay because if they don't pay, nobody will see what they post. And so this is where your software is coming in, that you kind of help those companies to make their own or to build their own company with your plugin. And yeah, to be able to really reach the customers and the whole community, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's re really about those that already want to hear from you. So, you have followers. Those are actually people that said, yes, I want to hear from you. I want to engage with you. I think it's really interesting what you post or it looks nice or whatever it might be. But they don't hear from you anymore. And I think the social media platforms are, of course, for awareness and for finding new people that might want to hear from you. For that, it's still very relevant. But for those people that already like you know, why should they not be in your space? And you have that direct communication and also the ability to actually reward them for their loyalty, for being active directly.
Wow. Yeah, well, super interesting. I personally didn't know that the reach is so bad or so difficult to still reach my followers and my customers. So thank you for that explanation. And I think it's super important what you're doing. I really like that.
Thanks. And I think one big area which is less on the brand side, but it's I think personally what really, really motivates me is that all of a sudden now people that were previously maybe not even able to earn store credits or engage with a brand in a meaningful way because they were sitting in markets that are just not addressed by that brand, can through our software contribute to a brand success. As an example, if you're a photographer who sits in, I don't know, South Africa or in Brazil, but the brand actually doesn't have a web shop there or doesn't engage with anything there, if you get remunerated in just in-store credits, it's not really relevant for that person. They can't earn a living from it. But if you can remunerate that person directly through to their wallet by, yeah, submitting really good pictures, for example, it's just amazing what you can do then in terms of job creation, value distribution by very easy means. So when people log in, for example, to a community space that is enabled by our software, there is an auto-generated wallet for them right in there. The brand gets to choose which wallet, which chain they want to use. So it's multi-chain. And by that, they can then re start remunerating those different users immediately, wherever they sit. And I think that's really, really important. That's something that motivates me personally a lot.
Yeah, that's super nice. And I think I know that you're living a life of a digital nomad, like a real digital nomad, because you just said, like, for people, it doesn't matter where they live, where they are based. And so I know that you're traveling a lot, like traveling or living in different places all over the world. So yeah, how is it to always change places and to live on so many different places in the world?
Yeah, so for the past, especially for the past year, it's been quite a lot of motion. There's been a lot of either meetings or then also some conferences. That is usually, yeah, putting me on the road. And what I love about it really is that I get to meet a lot of really cool people that are building great things. In the Web3 space, but also in the, I'd say, more traditional areas like e-commerce that I'm passionate about as well. So that's one. And then the second part is also it's very energizing for me to always getting those inputs from outside even. And yeah, especially when yeah we're a team, we're co-founders, but then getting that outside in inputs is just so useful for me.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, Web3 conferences and all the conference can be highly motivating, but sometimes it could be tiring as well because it's like so much content, so much input, so many people. Sometimes it's really, really crazy. But yeah, it's super nice being able to live and work from everywhere over the world, basically. That's super cool. So I would already come to one of my last questions. So we're always trying to finish the episode with a question that is, so tell us your favorite crypto story or blockchain story in 30 seconds. Something like once upon a time. Do you have anything that comes into your mind? Any nice story, anything you like to share?
So yes, one story is with my brother. So back in 17, I took him along to a blockchain meetup, and fast forward to now, he's holding Twitter Spaces in Spanish. Even it's not even his mother tongue, and talking about
Oh,
DeFi at the highest level, and it's just so much fun to, yeah, to see him how he just really took this and ran with it, and is just amazing what he's doing working with the Web3 Foundation, basically people from the Web3 Foundation at the yeah at the highest level of the whole DeFi space. So that's a very cool story and one that I'm passionately following. mostly.
Yeah, I think it's super important that you have somebody who's kind of helping you to enter the space. I think this is basically what you're saying, because especially back then in 2016 or 17, it was super hard to start. I mean, still, it's not that easy, but you have many possibilities through classes and online courses, basically. But still, it's always great if you have somebody who's kind of supporting you.
Yes, he didn't need a lot of support. I don't want to say that,
Okay, got
but
it.
it was really, really fun. I mean, it's so cool to see that. And I agree, though. I think there's still a bit of a barrier, maybe for some people when they hear the word, they just it just shuts down, or they think, oh, it's something out of this world, which, yeah, it definitely isn't, and it's getting much less so. So yeah, adoption, and also how easy it has become and seamless between Web 2 and 3, especially. That's also something that we're really focusing on a lot. So we really want to make it so that it's solving the industry problem. So we're really looking at what does the industry have, what are they missing, and the technology that we see is helping to solve a lot of those issues happens to be Web3. And this is for us really what is the main thing. So it's not, let's say, a goal in itself to create Web3 adoption, but that the goal in itself is to really add value to the world. And if, of course, there is Web3 that helps to do that, then that's amazing, and adoption happens out of that. So that's really the approach that we're taking.
Wow, I think this is super important. It's not about the adoption, but it's about the use cases behind. And of course, if the use cases are great and really helpful, then the adoption will grow by itself. But
Yes.
not the other way. It's not about adoption. It's about the use cases. Yeah, wow. This is, I think, a great thought.
And that's where we're coming in with that. So, when we can onboard a brand or an influencer and they invite their community, everybody who creates an account, who joins, they automatically get a wallet. And just the network effect of that generates adoption in itself. Even though adoption for us is not a goal per se as a standalone, but it's solving problems of the real world.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for sure, it's a network effect. Everything more, if more and more people are joining the space, it's easier to use it and there will be more use cases popping up, basically.
Yeah, 100%.
Super nice. It was really interesting talking to you, Roy. I think I learned a lot. I didn't know anything about the e-commerce space. So thank you for sharing your thoughts. And yeah, it was really nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much as well for all the questions, and it was super nice to talk to you too.
Love.